Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I am very pleased today to be here with Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen, who is a distinguished professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She is the author of a couple of books, her 2012 book, American Nietzsche, A History of an Icon and His Ideas, was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2012. She's the co-editor on a few volumes, but we're here today to talk about her 2019 book, The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History. That was published by Oxford, again, in 2019. I want to say before we start that, a one-volume history, intellectual history of America is something that, certainly could be very lengthy. It could be very dense. And this book is neither. It is about, as I look here, less than 200 pages of text, and it reads like a wonderful fiction. It is amazing how fast I got through this. So I think you will all enjoy it. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today.
Eric, thanks so much for having me.
Would you, this is a big book in an intellectual way, although a short book. Would you talk a little bit about what your overall or overarching theme is for this one volume, American Intellectual History?
An overarching theme. I actually think there are several, the themes actually kind of announced themselves to me, some of them as I was writing it, so I didn't go in thinking this is how I'm going to structure it. I just let the material sort of tell me how it wanted to be organized. And a couple of things I guess I would say that are the key themes. The first one is pluralism. And that is from the beginning, the first time a European stepped foot on this continent, they were encountering a world of multiple languages, of multiple cultures. And then, as you know, as more and more Europeans stepped foot on this continent, they brought with them more and more languages, more and more cultures. And so really from the start, America, one of the intellectual projects in this place has been for people to ask, who am I in this place amidst all of these people around me who are so different? So pluralism is something that's really, if you will, in our DNA. A second theme that, again, just sort of announced itself and I think is a leitmotif in the book is the issue of freedom, or call it liberty, call it freedom. But this is the whole reason why Europeans first make it over here is in some sense searching for religious freedom. And as you know, this carries on through the American Revolution and up until our own time. So that would be another animating idea, is that sort of ideas about and debates over what constitutes freedom, who gets to have it, what does that mean? And the last one is really that these conversations in America at the end of the day, they're fundamentally about truth. Who has truth? Who gets to adjudicate truth? Who's got the legitimacy, the authority in a democracy to make claims about what is true and what is untrue? And as I'm sure your readers know, this turned out to be quite a hot topic for over recent years, as truth isn't truth and truthiness and alternative facts became so important in our lingo. But that's where working on the book was so cool, because it just reminded me and hopefully my readers that this did not come ex nihilo, when Kellyanne Conway introduced the world to alternative facts, but actually these sort of contestations over truth really have been longstanding in American life.
And, it's such, again, it's such a relatively short book and covers so much ground. How did you decide to write a book like this? What was the motivation to write this really fascinating book?
So, Eric, you are the author of many books, so you might know this phenomenon. You know when a book chooses you? And you don't necessarily choose it. It chooses you. So for your audience, it's worthwhile knowing that I probably spent a good portion of my career saying I would never, and I mean never, try to write a synthetic intellectual history from the, you know, 16th century to the present. You know, what a monumental act of hubris and insanity. You know, how would you possibly do it? So, you know, and yet, I teach this material and absolutely love teaching it. So there's something that doesn't hold me back from doing it in the classroom. And so two things came together. One is that it dawned on me, what would it look like to try to transfer some of that energy and excitement that I try to bring in the classroom and I can see in my students? What would that look like in a book form? And the other thing was just the, you know, the heavens and the stars aligned, and this is precisely what Oxford University Press wanted. My editor, Nancy Tuff, magnificent editor, came to me and said, can you do this? And we want brief, right? People are, I mean, you understand with a podcast, you know, people, we have busy lives. You know, we don't want the 800-page version, you know, the doorstop version. You want to imagine it really as an invitation to intellectual history. And in my stupidity, I thought, well, the brief should make this easier. that'll be easier. Oh, okay, I can do this. But little did I realize what I was getting myself into. So, but I do feel like in some ways the book chose me, and I was just an instrument of its will.
No, my Strikes book is very similar. Actually, it actually originated with an idea from my own editor. Okay. And after I had written a previous book for the New Press, he was like, you know, I was kind of throwing ideas off of him. And he was like, have you thought about this? And I was like, wow, that's a great idea. So yeah, it does happen that way for sure. But, you know, and the brevity of it is difficult, especially, you know, and you get through it in part because you're such a fluid writer, which is just, I think, critical on issues like this. I mean, how does it relate to, I mean, what are sort of, when was the last time somebody took on a project like this?
Oh, Lord. It depends on, well, I right now I have in my head a bunch of authors racing and wanting to say, well, I tried to do it, or I sort of did it in my book. But truthfully, it's not, I would think the 80s. I mean, the book that I have in mind, which is the last sort of sweeping survey, was written in the 80s. And by Lewis Perry, for anyone who wants to read. It's a lovely book. It's a beautiful book. He's a great writer. Prior to that, you know, there's actually quite a few. I hold the chair that's called the Merle Curdy Chair in History at UW-Madison, and it's the name for the founder of the field of U.S. intellectual history. And he wrote a beautiful Pulitzer Prize-winning book in the 40s called The Growth of American Thought. So, you know, there's a history of historians trying to do this, but I will say that I think coming out of, if you will, the culture wars, probably the sort of fracturing of a sense of a common narrative and a common identity, the idea that you could then synthesize, you know, American intellectual history that would be inclusive, not just of white men, but also women, African Americans, Native Americans, other, you know, other immigrant groups, you know, be truly pluralistic in a way, and yet integrated to a common narrative. I think many people just thought this wasn't possible anymore. And I wanted to see if it was, and I actually think it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's my contention is that we're actually kind of in a golden age of historical writing. There's been a lot of people who are sort of figuring out, hey, you know, we can write and very inclusive histories, that are also, in really well written and accessible to a popular audience and selling copies and doing so. And I think your book is just a really great example of how this, you know, of this kind of thing. And I don't know, you know, 20 years ago, you may have written your book differently. I may have written my book differently. But it really works. And so that's great. And so, but it had been a long, long time since anybody had really taken this on. And I think that's just really tremendously important. So I guess, you know, I want to talk about some of the details of the book. You know, we've been kind of talking about the meta here, but I want to ask one more big question, which is sort of when you, this is, if this question is too big, just do what you want with it. But how do you sort of conceptualize intellectual history in America? Like, what are there, are there boundaries to it? Is it, you know, is it, you know, I think that traditionally, you know, it's just, you know, we kind of envision this is going to be a focus on, you know, on an Emerson and a Thoreau and a William James and, a, you know, et cetera. But you blow that up so broadly. So when you're thinking about intellectual history, the history of ideas, how are you sort of conceptualizing what that field looks like?
Okay, that's I love this question because I think about it all the time. I mean, I think even, you know, in all of my work, I need to rethink, okay, what is it I'm trying to do? Intellectual history fundamentally, you know, whatever, however anyone approaches it, is an interest in ideas and the people who make them or are moved by them. But what makes it a historical enterprise is that it always asks the question, why then and why there? Does that make sense? So it's like the context matters. You need to think about the context of why that person or why that idea at that moment, why does something that once had a hold on Americans' thought sort of fade from view? So the why then, why there is really, really crucial. And once you do that, it's sort of like anything goes in terms of what is intellectual history. Whether you're looking at, you could look at intellectual institutions. You could look at the big names, Eric, like the ones you mentioned. You can look at what I like to call intellectual history in the lower registers. So that is the intellectual history of average Americans. As you probably know, there are some extraordinary histories of laborers and work, you know, the working class mind, if you will. So it doesn't have to just work in the upper registers of elite professional thinkers. It can widen out from there. So basically, you know, it can look at the history of a concept. So whether it's justice or freedom or truth or the environment, how has that concept, that word, changed over time? What kind of meaning has it had? Who has enlisted it for what kind of fight? intellectual history could be looking at key documents. And trying to think, you know, whether it's the Constitution or translations, you know, of the Bible. The way that I talk about it in the book, and the way that I think, the reason why I think it appeals to a broader audience, and it seems accessible to a broader audience, and it is, as you probably remember, I put it in the book that it's a way to eavesdrop on the past. You know, fundamentally, what is intellectual history? It's just, it's a way to eavesdrop on the past. And again, I have to put in the disclaimer, my goal is not to spy on the, you know, inner thoughts of unsuspecting dead people, but rather it's this craving to connect with people from the past and wanting to, and so getting whatever records of their mind they leave behind, so we can listen into how they made sense of themselves, how they made sense of America, how they made sense of their moral worlds. So the eavesdropping is that, you know, there are methods for eavesdropping. It sounds a little loosey-goosey, but you know, that's sort of the if you will, what draws me to do it. But if I may say, at the end of the day, intellectual historians think that thinking is where the historical action is at, right? So it's not that, you know, these big events happen and then people think about it, but rather ideas themselves are agents in history. The way that people think, the way that people feel about things, the way that they're willing to commit themselves to certain kinds of causes or certain kinds of actions has, you know, transformed America. As we used to say, you know, it has agency, has is a real, can be causal factors. And so it's like looking at American history in the way that would be familiar to all of your listeners, but to say, what happens if we look at these same developments, these same stories, these same people, but try to front load what was going on in their minds? So that's okay. How I would frame it.
That's super fascinating. And, you know, one other way that you frame things in the introduction is the movement of ideas across various borders. Yeah. And you have sort of a border metaphor that goes through this. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So if you think about his intellectual history, again, I think an image of a kind of buttoned up scholar sitting, you know, it can be this very sort of staid or contained thing. Or if you think about history of the ideas, you think about this idea as if it's sort of frozen in time, but that's never how it is. And so intellectual history is about movement, flow, transfer. Yeah. Whether it's between one person and the next, or one person and an audience, a text and readers. And so intellectual history, properly understood, is looking at, if you will, transfer, flow, transition, movement. And when you start to look that for that, you see it everywhere. So where do you see it? One is the transferring of ideas across national or linguistic borders. You know, we may talk of American thought, and your listeners can't see me. I'm using scare quotes here, American thought. But, you know, so many ideas that we think of as American actually have foreign origins. And so there's a flow across the Atlantic, across the Pacific. And when there's a flow of ideas, there's also a translation of ideas. So you're talking about a linguistic translation that you have to pay attention to. So there's that sort of national and linguistic movement. Then there's, if you will, a temporal movement. So you and I and our listeners are all planted here in America, you know, maybe listeners across the globe in 2021, but some of the ideas that animate our own thinking come to us from late 19th century strikes, or, you know, evolution, or the Bible, or what have you. That is to say, they come across time. So one of the things that intellectual history needs to do is to look at the temporal flow of ideas, if that makes sense. I mean, we live in a long now. you know, every single one of our debates and our moment right now has a long, long history. And so one of the things that I try to do, right, is to think about what is that transfer, temporal flow, so that we're dealing with ideas, concerns that have long concerned Americans. And then the last one, if you will, is what I call sort of like the rupture of highbrow, lowbrow. And I mentioned this earlier, which is that ideas are not only what educated elite Americans have. Everybody has ideas. Everybody has worldviews. And what's so cool is when you start to pay attention if you look at the kind of, I call it the sort of promiscuous journey of ideas, it goes from low to high and high to low. I like to look at that, right? So there's a kind of anti-elitist impulse, if you will, in my own research, which understands that some of the most powerful ideas in America didn't necessarily come from professional thinkers, but it came from larger social movements or people, you know, working in the lower registers, if you will.
So, you know, we spent the first half of this interview thinking about big questions. And now I want to spend the second half sort of allowing you to, you know, to take one of the ideas or several of the ideas that you explore and kind of build them out over time or talk about how they may have developed at a particular time and their relevance today. So I'm just going to throw a few things out at you and see what you have to say about it, right? So one of them is this idea of American nationalism, you know, and, you know, when I think of that, and of course you get into this too, people like Ralph Waldo Emerson or Noah Webster, et cetera, but how did intellectual ideas of American nationalism develop? And I guess, how is that still relevant today when a lot of us are sort of rethinking America's role in the world, if that makes sense?
Yeah. That's a great question. There'd be many texts, ideas, moments where you could sort of date, if you will, the origins of the idea of American nationalism or national belonging or something we might call an American national identity. But the one I have to say that just sticks out to me is this period that you're talking about. So the period, early 19th century. And I think the reason why is, and it comes as a shock to many people, is the American Revolution did not accomplish this. I mean, Americans or the people who fought in the Revolutionary War didn't necessarily have a strong concept of what it meant for them to be an American. This was something that had to be achieved, you know, that had to be created and it had to be achieved. And what I think is really particularly interesting in the early 19th century is that, and I think one of the real influences here is out of Romanticism. One of the key ideas of Romanticism is this idea of belonging to a folk, belonging to a people. This is where we get the idea of a fatherland. And these ideas come, largely European, come to America and they strike terror in the hearts of many Americans, because the question was, what does make us American? And so I think you see in that early 19th century period, real efforts to create an American we. You mentioned Noah Webster, standardizing American English, the founding of the Library of Congress, the Encyclopedia Americana. So we see a lot of cultural projects trying to define what it means to be an American and sort of announce an American national identity. One thing that we can see is that the United States for the most part in this period, is still referred to in the plural. Right? So not the United States is, but the United States are, which I think already that linguistic framing tells you that in terms of the states people could not think in terms of a national we very effectively. And that's in some ways, that's a ludicrous claim. We know this because we get a civil war, but anyway, then I just think we can carry on that story, trying to figure out who gets to be an American, what does it mean to be an American, who's in, who's out?
Well, and I guess that leads to the next, that actually segues really well into the next question that I'm interested in you exploring, this question of who is an American, right? Because so much of American intellectual history, as you lay it out, has really been about dealing with cultural pluralism. Right. And are we going to accept a broad view of what an American is, or is it going to be a restrictive view? And that, I mean, that question is so central to our politics in the early 21st century. And so could you talk a little bit about that history of cultural pluralism in terms of the intellectual history of cultural pluralism and what in this broader, I guess, in this broader history, how does an intellectual historian help us understand these questions of cultural pluralism?
That's a wonderful question too. Let me try to see if I can give you two examples, one from the 18th century and one from the 20th. But I think what I would say to your listeners is, like, you could touch down at any moment in American history, and this is the problem. This is the problem, but this is also the possibility, right? Is just how to navigate this pluralism. The first example I would cite would be during the period of what we call the Enlightenment, mid to late 18th century. We think of the Revolution as itself a product of the American Enlightenment. And what's interesting is to think about the material conditions in America that the main Enlightenment thinkers are producing their ideas of freedom, their ideas of liberty. And so you have Thomas Jefferson, I write about this in the book, writing on Notes of the State of Virginia, disparaging African Americans. And he thinks, you know, he's got some authority because he owned 600 of them over the course of his lifetime. Yeah. So here you have one of the greatest authors about human liberty who cannot see that his own labor is made possible, his own ideas are made possible by the labor of, you know, 600 plus human beings. So that is to say, you know, and here, you know, we've got Thomas Jefferson as one of the great authors of religious pluralism too in America, right? So there's pluralism for some, but not for others. So there's, so in many ways, our notions of pluralism have been very blinkered, depending on the time and the place. Let's flash forward then, to the early 20th century. This is something I draw it in the book because he's a fabulous thinker, and not enough people know about him, but they should, because he's pretty much anyone who comes into contact with him, he becomes their all-time favorite, and that is Randolph Bourne. Randolph Bourne was, if you will, a lyrical leftist writer in the early 20th century. He was one of the great voices of the young intellectual renaissance of the pre-World War I period. I cannot recommend him enough to your audience. He writes about everything conceivable, from war to the meaning of the state, to being handicapped, he was disabled, to friendship. His stuff is deeply political, absolutely lyrical, and will just grab your conscience by the throat. So Born is, I mean, I think many intellectual historians agree, one of the great theorists of 20th century pluralism. And we believe this because he wrote a fabulous piece called Transnational America in 1916. And again, this is something that it's up full text, easy, accessible online. And what Born was responding to, he was very much against World War I. I mean, so, you know, he was a real oddity among progressives. And he thought that, you know, that World War I was what it was. It was the product of a kind of belligerent nationalism. And what terrified him was to see that that was starting to really happen at home in a very intense way with 100% American campaigns. And what he argues in this piece in Transnational America, so again, it's like a love letter to American pluralism, is to say, for starters, for number one, unless you're a Native American, you're a hyphenate. Yeah, you have no claim, special claim to this place. And so when you look around and you realize how so many of us are hyphenates and our hyphens pull us back to different times and different places, why wouldn't we embrace this in America and recommend that it's the thing that recommends America? Yeah, that we don't have a folk. But we have, right? So the kind of anxiety of lacking a folk that's inspiring the Noah Websters in the early 19th century, Randolph Bourne is saying, let's get over it and embrace it. This is what recommends this place. And this is the thing that can actually help us stay out of the war. We don't have to get into this, you know, contestation over nationalism and, you know, was also imperialism. So Transnational America is basically saying to be an American is to be transnational. And he really disliked the melting pot idea, you know, the idea that somehow you would just melt down to one, you know, he actually has some funny images of it. He was a very funny writer too. So this is, you know, this is again, a moment kind of a trying to celebrate pluralism at the very moment it's terribly under threat in America. Unfortunately, he wasn't much listened to at the time. And as you all know, we do enter World War I and the belligerent nationalism comes here in a big, big way. But that piece still has the power to speak across the century to us. Again, you know, sort of celebrating that the very thing about America that might make it really exceptional and wonderful is our pluralism. And it's something to embrace rather than try to squash.
Well, and that leads us, I mean, we really only have time for one more question issue, and there's just so much to talk about here. But I think that for that, I want to take what you just talked about with Born and bring it into the late 20th and early 21st centuries, right? Where, you know, you kind of close by talking a lot about identity politics and the culture wars, which are in many ways the same. You know, there's just a lot of similarities between the kind of world that Born is writing about and responding to and what we see today with a resurgent nationalism, as crude as it may have been under Donald Trump, and the kind of just very different visions of America that we see today. And so, you know, can you speak, what's your take as an intellectual historian on the recent past and present, on where we're at as an American people and an American nation? And, you know, I don't know if you can, no historian likes to be the, you know, the person we look for enlightenment about the present, because we deal with the past. But if you have anything to say about this present situation we find ourselves in, this would be a good time to do so.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that I've been really, I don't know, not stunned. How could I be stunned that the culture wars are back? But somehow I don't know, like it's real, they're really, really back in a big, big way. And I have to say, Eric, that it's the context of our moment now that helps me to see something also about the initial culture wars of the 1980s. And that is that they are an absolute confession of the absence of any real ideas. That's all it is. That's all it is. You grab on to the most, well, sorry, now I'm going to really out myself with your readers. But I mean, I think this whole thing right now with critical race theory is an absolute, it's absolutely absurd. There's nothing in the ideas. First of all, there's not even, I mean, the whole specter of it is absurd. That people grab onto these sort of cultural wedges when they don't have any policy ideas. You know, they do not want to address anything about our economic conditions, and they don't want to govern. So that's all. I mean, I think that unfortunately, though, the culture wars, as we saw in the 80s, it's a huge wedge in American life. I mean, they can be very effective, even if they really are fundamentally trafficking in specters and ghosts.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the Republican Party in 2020 would have literally no platform, actually have no platform, and then critical race theory sort of be, you know, or some vision of critical,
like, really, this is what you want. This is what you want to rally around. So, yeah, and so it's funny that this period, this moment, is helping me to see something new also in the 90s. In the 80s and the 90s. Well, this 80s, and then spilling into the 90s is the height of the culture wars. I have to say, if I may, when I look back at it, though, I do think there was more genuine fear in that moment. And here it feels, so that is to say, I do think that the culture warriors, if you will, that they were genuinely worried about, you know, fill in the blank, whether it was about Mapplethorpe and sexual licentiousness, whether it was the rising of the colored races, you know, the specter of secularism. I actually think that a lot of the big name culture warriors actually were worried about those things. And right now I actually think it's all theater. I think it's absolutely all theater. So, but does it make it any less pernicious or dangerous? Right.
Maybe more so. The cynicism makes it even more dangerous. But so I guess this is as a quick follow-up then. I mean, would you say that, because obviously we still live in a time where ideas are floating around and we're debating them. But would you say that the sheer reality of having these debates has become politicized? In other words, that the center or left, however you want to define it, is still engaging in a kind of intellectual world and the right is just sort of not? I mean, how would you, you know, if the freak out of a critical race theory is a example of the vacuum of ideas in modern conservatism, where do you see the sort of ideas being generated in the United States at this point in time?
Well, I mean, you know, here's the ecumenical part of me. They are all over the place, but some ideas are good and some are bad. And some, you know, are based on evidence and others aren't, right? Some are just sort of chest thumping claims and fighting words, and others have real grounding to them. So, I mean, in a spirit of you know, ecumenical pluralism, I would say there are ideas all around us coming all over the place. Just some traffic in reality and commitments larger than, you know, the self, or larger than inherited wealth or whatever it may be. If I were just going to be cute, I would say, it might be nice if the GOP wanted to become the party of ideas again. And it's interesting to think about historically, when did they seed that? Yeah. So of course there are some very robust and very important conservative thinkers, but they have no real, many of them have no real hold on the GOP today. But I'd be careful what you wish for. I don't know.
Right. Fair enough. Maybe it's better this way. I don't know. Yeah.
No,
right.
I don't know. I really don't know. But it's just interesting to see something that was such a like a point of pride and one of the political parties just absolutely totally fade from view. You could say the same thing about the Democratic Party, you know, certain ideas that were once animating, you know, why are they so muted or why are they, you know, so again, I'm not pointing fingers one way or another. But I do think it's just the it's interesting to see a political party really identify itself as a party of ideas and then absolutely hand that away. And as you said, you know, not even have a political platform.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating time to live in, certainly at the very least, and it's a fascinating book. And so we will close here and I'll let you get back to your day. We have been speaking today with Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen about her great 2019 book, The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History, that's published by Oxford University Press, and you can certainly order it at your favorite website or bookstore. And I very strongly encourage you to do so. You'll enjoy it a lot. Jennifer, thanks again.
It was wonderful talking to you, Eric. Thank you so much.
We'll be back for a podcast soon. Thank you all.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,